This is VOA's International Edition. Today's Tuesday, September 5th. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, U.S. leaders talk tough as the world looks to contain the threat of North Korea.
To the members of the Security Council, I must say, enough is enough.
President Trump will make a major announcement on the fate of immigrants in the U.S.
One of the most cruel and ugly decisions ever made in the modern history of this country by a president.
Also ahead, Kenya sets a date for a new presidential election. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, there were strong words coming from U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley Monday as the United States continues to look at options for dealing with the rising threat of North Korea.
Kim Jong-un's action cannot be seen as defensive. He wants to be acknowledged as a nuclear power. But being a nuclear power is not about using those terrible weapons to threaten others. Nuclear powers understand their responsibilities. Kim Jong-un shows no such understanding. His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war.
Haley spoke at an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, which was scheduled after North Korea said it detonated the hydrogen bomb, and 6 days after the council strongly condemned what it called Pyongyang's outrageous launch of a ballistic missile over Japan. Members called for punishing the country with even stronger sanctions for its powerful nuclear test.
The United States will look at every country that does business with North Korea as a country that is giving aid to their reckless and dangerous nuclear intentions. And what we do on North Korea will have a real impact on how other outlaw nations who seek nuclear weapons choose to conduct themselves in the future. The stakes could not be higher. The urgency is now.
Less than a month ago, the council imposed its stiffest sanctions yet on Kim Jong-un's reclusive nation. And as Secretary of Defense James Mattis also had strong words in response to the threats.
Any threat to the United States or its territories, including Guam or our allies, will be met with a massive military response, a response both effective and overwhelming.
Also on Monday, President Donald Trump spoke by phone with South Korean President Moon Jae-in. The two leaders agreed to remove the limit on the payload of South Korean missiles. VOA's Ira Melman asked Jean Lee, global fellow with the Wilson Center in Seoul, if Pyongyang has outmaneuvered the U.S.
North Korea has a very carefully crafted strategy. And that requires that the United States have a very carefully crafted strategy as well. However, one of the things we're seeing is mixed messages coming out of the White House, not to mention mixed messages coming out of the White House and the Blue House here in South Korea. So we're seeing some confusion, and that is only really going to benefit the North Koreans. They are going to relish that. They are going to take advantage of that. What we needed to see, frankly, was complete unity on the part of the United States and its allies. The strongest stance would be for the United States and its allies in this region to show that they're on the same page in terms of how to deal with North Korea. Exposing the rift between Seoul and Washington is not good for the United States or for anyone dealing with North Korea. That's something that the North Koreans will take advantage of. So it does put Washington in a position of weakness in a certain sense.
You mentioned that North Korea, the DPRK, does have a solid plan in mind. What is that plan as you see it?
North Korea has a couple of objectives. The leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, has a few objectives. One of the things he does need is to create a kind of wartime frenzy. So he needs to create tension. That tension and rhetoric from Washington helps him justify and rationalize testing nuclear devices and ballistic missiles. And so the more tense the situation is, the more rationale he has to continue testing. And the more he can test, the closer he gets to perfecting this technology. So if Washington is thinking the tougher we talk, the more likely they are to back down. That is completely wrong. That is a complete misreading of the North Korean psychology. If anything, it just further emboldens them. And so there's a basic lack of understanding in terms of what would get the North Koreans to back down and to stop testing. That said, the United States and South Korea are perfectly entitled to show they need to show their own people that they can defend their populations from any kind of threat. So it's completely understandable, the show of force that we're seeing. I think what's important is what happens next. I'm sitting here in South Korea, so we're right in the path of any potential destruction. What I don't want to see is for this to tip over into military conflict. What I would like to see is a very carefully coordinated strategy on the part of the U.S. and its allies to de-escalate these tensions and eventually come up with a strategy to get the North Koreans to stop building nuclear weapons and testing ballistic missiles.
And what would that strategy be in your mind?
It's understandable that they're going to want to punish North Korea for these very dangerous and illicit provocations. But at some point, they're going to have to give everybody a way out, a face-saving way out of this. So they're going to have to back down. All sides are going to have to back down. We're going to need to see a period of quiet and eventually some discussion about how to resolve this. So what I think that is terrifying for us here in the region is to see the tensions reach a certain point where somebody is going to feel like they need to make a move, and if that could trigger some sort of conflict that could be disastrous for this region. That's certainly not what we want.
Is there anything in your estimation that can cause North Korea to back down from its current trajectory?
It would be very important for the White House and the other capitals in the region to think about what North Korea's motivations and incentives are. What would induce them to stop doing this? And there are a couple things. For one, North Korea wants to be recognized by the United States as a nuclear power. That is something that Washington has not been willing to do, understandably. They want that respect. And that's something that Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, can take back to his people and say, I know I'm young, I know I'm inexperienced, but look, I've got the president of the world's big superpower to acknowledge me and our country as a peer. And so there's some desire for legitimacy here going on in terms of what the North Korean leader wants.
That's Jean Lee, Global Fellow from the Wilson Center in Seoul, South Korea. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. U.S. farmers are looking for the economic boost from NAFTA negotiations. China attacks President Trump's threat to curb trade because of North Korea. In Harvey's wake, new financial realism hits the White House. And U.S. national park icons are now threatened by wind-frenzied wildfires. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The White House is expected to announce a decision about Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, on Tuesday, with early reports indicating the president will end the program that has shielded hundreds of thousands of young undocumented immigrants from deportation. President Donald Trump came into office with a promise to eliminate DACA, but at times seemed to ease up on that rhetoric and said young immigrants brought to the U.S. as children shouldn't worry.
They shouldn't be very worried. I do have a big heart. We're going to take care of everybody. We're going to have a very strong border. We're going to have a very solid border where you have great people that are here that have done a good job. They should be far less worried.
But since his inauguration, the president has prioritized bolstering the country's deportation system, calling for thousands more immigration and border agents to be hired. Officials who describe the move say it would come with a six-month delay meant to give Congress time to address the issue. The program was created by former President Barack Obama. And obviously concerned Senator Bernie Sanders spoke about it at a rally in New Hampshire Monday.
As part of Trump's effort to divide us up, I must say that what he is proposing right now, and we think the decision may be imminent, to end the DACA program, is one of the most cruel and ugly decisions ever made in the modern history of this country by a president. Imagine telling 800,000 young people, bright young people, exemplary young people, kids who are now in college, kids who are working, kids who are serving the military, young people who have never known another nation other than the United States of America, that they are going to lose their legal protections.
A protest is planned in front of the White House later this morning. Well, still reeling from the devastating effects of Hurricane Harvey, the east and Gulf coasts of the U.S. are now eyeing Hurricane Irma, which late Monday developed into a powerful Category 4 storm. Emergency officials in the Caribbean warned that Irma could dump up to 25 centimeters of rain, unleash landslides and flash floods, and generate waves up to 7 meters. Joining me now for more on this storm and its potential impacts is Dennis Feltkin, spokesman for the National Hurricane Center in Miami, Florida. So, Dennis, thanks for being with us. Where is Irma now, and what can you tell us?
Well, the hurricane hunters have been flying this storm pretty continuously for the last 24 hours, and the U.S. Air Force plane in it found that Irma had strengthened. Irma is now up to a Category 4 hurricane with maximum sustained winds of 130 miles per hour. You may recall that was the landfall wind speed and category of Hurricane Harvey about 10 days ago. So this is in that range already. Mm. Irma is about 500-600 miles to the east of the Leeward Islands, moving to the west, and it is going to be impacting the islands here. Irma is going to affect the northeastern Leeward Islands as a major hurricane, a Cat 4, accompanied by life-threatening wind, storm surge, and torrential rainfall. And hurricane warnings are up for portions of the Leeward Islands. So anybody in that region needs to be rushing their plans to completion very quickly because the winds will be hitting tropical storm force by later on Tuesday afternoon. And looking ahead, looks like the British and the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico are in its path, so a hurricane watch is up for that area.
Is it too soon to know whether this will actually make landfall and strike the mainland United States?
There is an increasing chance of seeing some impacts from Irma in the Florida Peninsula and the Florida Keys later this week and right through the weekend. But essentially where it would make landfall and what those impacts would be, that's still a little bit unclear. Right now on the five-day track, we still have it not onto the U.S. coastline. It's essentially just north of the Cuban coastline, east of Havana and south-southeast of Miami by a couple of hundred miles. But it definitely has the five-day track cone. South Florida is in the five-day track cone right now. So that tells us that the center of the storm could be anywhere in that cone in 5 days. So the best advice for anybody in Florida right now is to be watching the latest advisories in the track and check your supplies. Make sure your hurricane plan is in place.
My understanding is that the governor of Florida has already declared a state of emergency for the entire state. Would that just be as a precaution in case it should strike that state in a significant way?
Well, a state of emergency, as issued by Governor Rick Scott of Florida, essentially allows a whole lot of resources to become implemented, to go into the system there. It doesn't mean everybody starts running into the streets. That's not what a state of emergency means. It means that the resources that are available to the state of Florida at the county level and at the state level all of a sudden are activated. That's what a state of emergency means.
If this takes a left turn and does hit the U.S. mainland, is it expected to be pretty significant?
Through 5 days, this is still a major hurricane, and a major hurricane is going to have major hurricane impacts. But again, there's a great deal of uncertainty when you start getting out to days 4 and 5. There's a reason that track forecast cone, especially at day 5, is about 200 miles either side of the famed skinny black line. Mm. So all folks need to be doing this over the southeastern United States, particularly Florida, and especially South Florida, need to be watching the latest advisories and getting their hurricane plan in place. We've got plenty of time to watch this, but they need to be thinking about it.
Where are we in terms of the hurricane season?
We have just passed the halfway point. It's a six-month season that began on June 1st, ends on November 30th. So here we are on Labor Day, September 4th, and we're just past the halfway point. Now, having said that, the peak of the season runs from essentially mid-August through late October, and the statistical peak day is September 10th. So we're pretty much in it right now.
Okay. We could see more forming.
We certainly will see more. In fact, we're watching two other areas of disturbed weather. One is to the east-southeast of Irma, which we stating that there's a high probability that this will become a tropical depression during the next 48 to 84 hours. And if it gets storm strength, that will become Jose. We're also watching a little area of disturbed weather in the far southwestern Gulf of Mexico, which has some potential for tropical cyclone development as well. So there's all sorts of little areas that we're watching. But right now, the big ticket is Irma.
All right. Dennis Felkin, National Hurricane Center. We appreciate it. Turning now to what's trending on social media, VOA's Andrew Palchewski joins us. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, Hurricane Irma is churning towards the United States, potentially going to make landfall somewhere on the eastern seaboard. And there's a map of this supposed track of Hurricane Irma that's going around social media that actually shows it going south of the United States, up through the Gulf of Mexico, and slamming into the southeast coast of Texas that was just affected by Hurricane Harvey.
No.
That's what the reaction is from a lot of people. In fact, it's been shared tens of thousands of times. But here's the thing. This map is fake. It's not the actual track of the hurricane. It maps it out in
fake weather?
Yes, it maps it out in this fake map to go towards Texas, but in actuality, the real map still has it well to the east of the United States, and in fact, the hurricane watchers say that it's too early to tell where exactly the storm is going to go.
Okay.
So the National Weather Service is trying to get the word out on social media that this map is fake, and they have some big muscle behind them because it is actually illegal to fake a National Weather Service weather map. It is actually against the law. So if they can trace this back to whoever started this, they could potentially face legal consequences. Now, trying to do that on social media can be rather difficult.
Right.
And especially now that other people have shared it, it might be hard to track and see who actually began this. But if you do see that map out there that says the hurricane is heading for the U.S. state of Texas or anywhere outside of the Caribbean, it is fake. Because right now that hurricane, so far, they suspect it'll make landfall somewhere in the Caribbean, but it's still too early to tell.
All right, Andrew. We've been watching. Thank you very much. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, meanwhile, in Texas, floodwaters may be slowly starting to recede, but many Houston freeways and neighborhoods near dams and reservoirs are still underwater. Many flood victims are still having to stay in shelters. There are several mosques that have opened their doors to the larger community. The volunteers and temporary residents in One West Houston Mosque learned something they didn't expect. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports from Houston.
Passing the time in shelters hasn't been easy for flood victims who don't know when they can go home. 19-year-old Sarah Al-Azad from Saudi Arabia has only been in Houston for 4 months.
We've never had any experience before like that with any kind of storm from where I came from. We didn't take it that seriously, and when the flood happened, it was a life-changing experience.
Al-Azad, whose mother is Indonesian and whose father is Syrian, is here with her family and her cousins. As the children play, all the adults are anxious to get home and don't know when the mandatory evacuation will be lifted. But here, they are safe and surrounded by kindness.
We were really amazed. A lot of people who came here to get the temporary shelter. In fact, people came and took them to their homes. So we were really touched by that.
People from the community on the west side of town who did not receive any flood damage have been coming to the shelter to donate items such as sheets and blankets and even toys. And for some of them, it's the first time inside a mosque.
I have never been inside a mosque. I was a bit apprehensive about the which door to go into. And a young lady met me in the parking lot and led me.
People of all faiths, they have come together. They're working just purely on the basis of humanity, nothing else, just human beings helping each other. And then we learn from different people because everyone has different backgrounds, different thought processes. We learn a lot through this.
Coming here dispelled certain assumptions for Mandel.
They're a lot more warmer than I expected. On the males. The females, I've always expected kindness and warmness, but sometimes I, you know, tend to shy away from Muslim men because I don't know the traditions and what I should do correctly.
It was also a learning experience for Chaudhry.
They're human, you know. They're our friends, and they want to help the humanity. Without any discrimination, without any fear, nothing. They just want to help people.
Al-Azad says her experience at this shelter is nothing like the anti-Muslim rhetoric she sees on the news.
People from not the Islamic faith coming and donating, it made me have a different perspective about the U.S. That's like really, really, really nice of you, like, you know, as in the non-Muslims to come in here and donate for us.
The volunteers say breaking down barriers and working together will make the community stronger as they rebuild the city after the flood. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Houston.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Yes, we can. Former President Barack Obama's catchphrase was borrowed from a petite, fiery American Latina named Dolores Huerta. Not many people know Huerta's contributions to American civil rights, but the documentary Dolores by filmmaker Peter Bratt reveals 70 years of her rich life and work as a union leader and activist. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
Dolores is an icon. She's not afraid to speak truth to power.
Dolores Huerta, who is an old friend of mine.
Dolores Huerta.
Dolores Huerta gave voice to disenfranchised Latinos in America.
After I had seen the miserable conditions of farm workers, Cesar Chavez said, we have to organize a union.
So the activist joined U.S. labor leader Cesar Chavez to organize the National Farm Workers Association in California.
We had benefits. We had a life insurance plan. We had an office. We started a credit union, the first farm worker credit union in the history of the United States of America, where people could get loans. We had a cooperative store. We did services. We did immigration work. We did their income taxes. We had like a five-year plan to have a national strike in the Central Valley because we wanted all of the growers to negotiate together.
It was beyond question the largest gathering on behalf of farm workers in California history.
I wish they'd all go back to where they came from. We have no labor troubles.
Huerta also helped change voter registration in California, leading to a larger voter turnout in the state.
One of the major bills that we passed was that you could register voters door-to-door in California. Before that, you had to go down to the courthouse, from Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, to register to vote. And of course, working people couldn't do that because they were working at those particular hours.
Huerta says the film Dolores underscores the significance of social activism in the United States.
I believe a lot of the issues that we have in the United States right now, because people do not know the contributions of people of color, that indigenous Native Americans were the first slaves, that African slaves built the White House and the Congress, that it was the people from Mexico and the people from Asia that built the infrastructure of our country. And labor unions are the ones that really, you know, we have the 8-hour day, we have the weekends, we have safety standards, we have unemployment insurance, disability insurance, we have public education, we have Social Security. All of this was fought for by people in labor unions.
Unfortunately, says filmmaker Peter Bratt, many Americans do not know this part of their history.
Stories like Dolores's
oftentimes get marginalized. And even Dolores is kind of painted as a foreigner, you know. Dolores is, she's as American as apple pie or chips and salsa, you know what I mean? And her story is an American story, and it should be told.
Yes, we can.
As for that famous slogan, Dolores Huerta is behind that, too.
We were organizing in Arizona, and when I met with some of the professional Latinos, they told me in Spanish, no, allá in over there in California, you can do all of that. In Arizona, no se puede. And my response was to them was, sí se puede, sí se puede.
In 2012, Dolores Huerta was honored with the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Today, at age 87, she is continuing her community work with the Dolores Huerta Foundation. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Down with violence! Abajo! Down with racism! Abajo! Down with sexism!
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
An editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the first Monday of September every year, the United States pauses to honor its workers and the contributions they make to our nation's prosperity. On September 5th, 1882, more than 10,000 men and women paraded through the streets of Manhattan to celebrate the first Labor Day. New York's Central Labor Union organized the day of celebration in honor of the workers who fought to secure higher wages, shorter hours, and better working conditions for laborers. It was a day of celebration, but also a day of sacrifice. The workers sacrificed that day's wages to demonstrate their commitment to gaining fair compensation for hard work. American workers transformed the United States and the world with a quality of life never seen in history. American farmers export more food than any country in the world and produce food more efficiently per capita than China and India, the world's largest food producers. The United States exports more refined petroleum than any other country in the world, and it exports more than 40% of the world's spacecraft and aircraft, and more than 11% of the world's electronics. America has the largest road network of any country in the world, with over 6.5 million kilometers of road, over 4.3 million miles of paved road, and over 2.2 million miles of unpaved road. 90% of American households own at least one automobile, and American workers produce almost 3 million cars per year, nearly 5% of cars produced per year worldwide. A key element in America's economic success is the freedom that every American enjoys, the freedom to choose their work, the freedom to innovate and create new industries and revitalize old ones. What we are witnessing today is the renewal of the American spirit, said President Donald Trump. We do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather to let it shine, said President Trump. We will shine as an example for everyone to follow.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.